Well, this morning we're going to start out by playing a game. Who's up for playing a game this morning? All right. Woo! This is a game. It's an audience participation game, and it's one that you play all the time, I'm sure. It's called What is the Brand and What Does It Stand For? Right? You play that all the time, right? You know, you're sitting around at home, and we say, hey, let's play that game. Well, here's the deal. We're going to put a well-known brand or logo on the screen. Then you're going to say, what is the brand and what does it stand for? All right? You got it? All right. So just try the first one. We'll start easy. All right. What? McDonald's. What does McDonald's stand for? Okay, cheeseburgers, that's right. Cheap, inexpensive cheeseburgers. And the best Coca-Cola on the planet. How they do that, I don't know. But right, theirs is better than anybody's. All right, next one. Starbucks. What does Starbucks stand for? Overpriced coffee. That's exactly right. If you said that, you are correct. And a great atmosphere so that you can enjoy your overpriced coffee and feel better about spending the $5 for the cup of coffee, right? That's what Starbucks is. All right, next. Apple. What does Apple stand for? Computer electronics technology. All the coolest gadgets, all right? If you are cool, you have one of these products in your pocket, in your purse, on your desk, somewhere. That's why I'm not cool. I don't have any of that's only one of the reasons I'm not cool, but that is one. I don't own any of those products, but that's what that's for. How about this one? Okay, you guys were good. I didn't know if you know that one. I thought maybe if you didn't have kids, you'd need this help. So I put that up there. But all right, so Disney, what is the brand of Disney? What does it stand for? There was a cacophony of responses there. Overpriced fun, I heard. There were some different things happening. Some of you might, depending on where you're at, and kid-wise, you might think it's a cult. Other of you might think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But there, you can think lots of different things about Disney, but we all know what Disney is, all right? Well, what about this one? What brand is that? The church, Christianity, Jesus. What does that brand stand for? Okay, I heard some different things. Now, would you agree that the answer that we church people might give to that question, what does the brand of Christianity stand for, might be different than if we went to the high school in the middle of next week when all the kids got back and went roamed the halls and just said, hey, what does this brand stand for? Or if in a couple of weeks we went to IU's campus and asked, what does this brand stand for? Or we just went to the mall today and said, what does this brand stand for? We'd probably get different answers, wouldn't we? And it might not be the same answers that we would give today. Well, this morning, we are starting a brand new series entitled Brand New. See what I did there? All right, that's pretty exciting. But the reason we're doing that is because we're going to be talking about the brand of Christianity. What is it that we're supposed to be thinking about in terms of the brand of Christianity, maybe what the culture thinks about, how those things are different or the same, and what that all means. Now, before we go any further, I want full disclosure, that title video that we just saw and the concept and some of the content from the this message series comes from Andy Stanley and North Point Church down in Atlanta. One of our Bible study groups recently went through this material, and several of them came to me and said, you've got to watch this. You've got to teach this to our church because it was meaningful to them. And I looked at it and I said, you're right. This is of value to I think, all of us as we look at what the brand of Christianity means. Now, so I've modified the content quite a bit, but if you want to see the original version, you can go online and see what he had to say. But would you agree with me, as we continue, that the brand of Christianity maybe has become a little tarnished lately? Would you agree with that? That the brand of Christianity is not what it used to be. And that's really unfortunate because, as we talked about last week, we have a message that matters, right? We have good news. We have, as we talked about last week, a message that has the potential to change life for everybody that you know. It has the potential to make a practical difference in the life here and now for everybody that you know, and it has the potential to make an eternal difference in the next life for everybody that you know. We have a message that matters, and so it's unfortunate that when people see the brand of Christianity, they don't always have that good, positive viewpoint. And so people can resist or reject the church or Christianity for all kinds of different reasons. But as we go through this series, I'm hopeful that for those of us who would call ourselves Jesus followers or Christians or whatever you would call yourself, that we would be sure that what we are following or what we have signed up for is actually the brand that Jesus came to establish and that he came to promote and that the early church promoted. And if you're not a Christian or a Jesus follower and you're just kind of checking things out and you've resisted things about the church or you've resisted things about what you think is Christianity or the Bible, you owe it to yourself to make sure that what you're resisting is actually the real thing and not some imitation version of the thing that maybe you've experienced because of a church that you grew up in or your experience with Christians somewhere along the way. And so together we can look at what this brand of Christianity was originally supposed to be. Now, from an outsider's perspective, think about this. What is the church? Just from an outsider's perspective. We're going to put it on the screen here. From an outsider's perspective, the church is simply a community of people who follow the teaching of a man sent from God to explain God and to clear the path to God. Wouldn't you say that's a pretty accurate description of what the church is to the outsider? Now, for us insiders, we would say it a little bit differently, right? We would add a little more detail. We would add a little more clarity to what we think who Jesus is. We would say we're a community of people that follow Jesus, who we believe is the Son of God, who died on the cross for our sins, who rose again from the grave and made it so that we could have a relationship with God. We would add all those things in there. But to the outsider, we're just a community of people who follow the teaching of a man sent from God to explain God and to clear the path to God. I mean, what should be resistible about that, right? That's pretty benign, wouldn't you agree? That should be a pretty, there's nothing to resist about that. And when you think about it, the teachings that Jesus gave, I mean, the application of his teachings were what? It was really only one or two, depends on how you look at it, but they all kind of go together. The first thing he said was to what? Love God, right? Okay, that's not too threatening, all right? Love God. That shouldn't be resistible. And the second thing he said was important and kind of the application was to love your neighbor, right? To love people. And then because religious people like to find loopholes, right? And so he had to tell a story to explain what he meant about loving your neighbor. And he told this story that was a famous story that you've heard of perhaps. It's called The Good Samaritan, where he showed that what he meant by loving your neighbor or loving people was that you loved everybody, even your enemy. And so the application that Jesus taught for all of his teaching was to love God, to love people, even including your enemy. I mean, what's resistible about that? That doesn't seem like it should be anything that should be resisted. In fact, the early church grew like crazy and caught on primarily because of the way they loved one another, the way they loved people. People looked at them and they said, these people treat each other differently than anything I've ever seen. This is incredible. They treat their women differently than anybody else treats women. They treat them like real people, and they don't like buy and sell them. They're like real people. They treat their kids differently. They value children. Not only do they take care of their own women and children, but they look even outside themselves, and they take care of other people's women and children. They take care of widows and orphans, and the way they love each other is incredible. And so it was irresistible for a time for those people that see them. And really, at the beginning in the early church, there was only two groups of people that kind of resisted and pushed back against Christianity, and they did so for, they were totally different groups, but they did so for primarily the same reasons. You had the Jewish religious leaders who rejected and resisted Christianity because of the Christians' persistent belief and saying that Jesus was the Messiah, that Jesus was the Son of God. And since the Jewish religious leaders had killed Jesus, well, that didn't reflect so good on them. And so they rejected and resisted the teaching. But the other group that resisted the teaching or resisted the movement of the early church was the Roman authorities, again, for about the same reason, because those early followers of Jesus insisted that Jesus was their ultimate authority, that Jesus was, in fact, God, and he was God's son. And, of course, the Caesar and the Roman authorities didn't appreciate that. Caesar thought of himself as God and of the highest authority. And so if a group of people came along saying, no, wait a minute, our ultimate allegiance is to this higher authority, Jesus. And so they resisted the movement early on of Jesus. But wouldn't that be something if, like the early church, that the thing that people resisted about us was our unswerving loyalty to Jesus as Messiah, to Jesus as the ultimate authority in our life? Wouldn't that be something if that is what people, if they were going to resist Christianity, if they were going to resist the church if that was what it was that they were resisting. Simply our loyalty to Jesus and our loyalty to his word as authority. What if we were known as such neat people to be around, kind of like the early church, that people might, they might say, well, even if I don't believe everything they say, I'm not saying I sign up to everything, but boy, how would you like to live next to one of them? I'd like for one of them to be my neighbor. You know, I might not believe or buy into everything that they teach, but I'd like to hire as many of them as I could, because those guys are just incredible workers. The way they treat other people and the way they, just the stuff that they bring with them in a positive sense is incredible. I want to hire as many of those kind of people as I can. Or, I'm not sure I believe all this stuff and all this, I'm not sure about it, but boy, I sure hope my son marries one of those people. Wouldn't that be great if that's the way that people looked at us and looked at the brand of Christianity? That's what Peter had in mind when he wrote to the early Christians, that we were to live such good lives among the pagans that though they accused the pagans, that's just people who aren't followers of Jesus, just the world. If we live such good lives among people out in the world, that even though they would accuse us of doing wrong, they would see our good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us when Jesus comes back. Wouldn't that be great if that was what we were known for, if that's how we were identified as a brand of people? Well, that was the goal. That's how things were supposed to start out. That's what the Christian brand was supposed to be. But if that's how things started out, how did they go so wrong? Or how did the church become so resistible? I think, as we'll see today and throughout this series, that the reason the church became resistible, or parts of the reasons why the church became resistible, is not because of the new things that Jesus introduced, but because of some of the old things that snuck their way back in to this whole Jesus movement. In fact, if I can generalize for a little bit, all of the religious systems in the world before Jesus came kind of operated under the same principle. They were different, but they had a lot of similarities involved. And that is, they operated under the same kinds of rules or of the same kinds of framework. And that is, and what we're going to call the temple model. Okay, all religions up to the point of Jesus, we're going to call the temple model. Now, those of you who are church people, your brain automatically rushes to the Old Testament, automatically rushes to the Jews and the temple of the Old Testament, and that certainly was a part of that, but it was much greater than that, much more beyond that. Even, you know, at that time, the Roman people and their gods, they had this temple model, or the Greeks and the way they worshiped their gods, even back as far as the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Babylonians, and really almost every religion still today operates under some form or fashion of this thing that we're going to call the temple model. And it has several different kind of aspects that go along with that. The first thing that's in place with the temple model is that there are sacred places, if you're filling out your notes, sacred places. That is, there's a temple, there's a special building, there's a shrine, there's some certain place that you would come to interact with God, that you would come to do whatever interacting, to make yourself right, to pay your homage, to pay your tax or your gift or your offering, or to make yourself right with God, would be in this special sacred place. It's where you would go because that's where God either lived, or that's where he hung out, or that's where he had designed the God or the gods, whatever your belief system would. That's where you would interact with God. There was a temple, a special place. Second thing is, there is always, to go along with the sacred places, there were sacred texts, right? There was some sort of scripture of some sort. There was some oracle. There was some teaching, some written down system of things that were to be followed. And those texts were generally housed in the sacred places, right? And so these sacred places had these sacred texts. And then also you have sacred men. The sacred men would be the people that interpreted those sacred texts. They would hang out in those sacred places, interpret the sacred text to tell people exactly what the god or the gods meant when they said these things. And they were kind of the gatekeepers from who was in and who was out, who was on the good side of the gods or God, and who was on the bad side. And if you were on the bad side, what you had to do to get on the good side. Okay, so these sacred men interpreted the sacred text. They all hung out in the sacred places, and that was kind of the model, not just of Judaism, but of all of religion up to that point, and still many religions today. As you can see, that temple model, that kind of way of thinking, gave lots of authority and lots of power to those sacred men. Because they were the ones that got, sometimes women, but mostly men, they got to interpret those sacred texts and tell people who was in and out. They served as the gatekeeper, so they had incredible power. Jesus came along to kind of do away with all that and to start something totally new, but some of that thinking has kind of snuck its way back into this new thing, this new Jesus movement. Now, some of you are back there saying, well, yeah, that sounds exactly like what we do. We have a sacred place. We come to a building every Sunday. We're sitting in it right now. And we have a sacred text. We call it the Bible, right? We have that. And so that's what's different about that. We have a sacred man. You sit up there and we listen to everything you say and do exactly what you say. Yeah, right. Thanks for that. I wish you wouldn't have laughed quite so loud. But you would say that, wait, isn't Christianity, isn't that just kind of an updated, kind of new and improved version of this temple model? And I can understand why you would think that, especially based on probably your, you know, history in church or what your, you know, your, how you were raised or, you know, what you have thought about when you thought about church or Christianity. But the reality is that even though it might seem like just a new and improved version, and we'll kind of jump to our bottom line, the reality is that the arrival of Jesus signaled an end to the temple model. It signaled an end to this old way of relating to God. It signaled an end to, for the Jews, the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, but for every other religion as well, for the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks, for current people everywhere of no religious background. It changed totally the way that people were to interact with God. The arrival of Jesus signaled the end of this temple model and the beginning of something entirely new. The arrival of Jesus signaled the end of the temple model and the arrival of something totally new. It wasn't temple model 2.0. Okay, this wasn't just an addendum to ancient Judaism. This was something totally new. Never before seen, Jesus came to institute totally new things. It was brand new. And so if we're called the old model, the temple model, we'll just call the new model the Jesus model, okay? And the Jesus model, just to kind of help you explain how it's a little bit different from the, not a little bit different, but totally different from the old way. In the Jesus model, there are no more sacred places, right? There are no more sacred places because Jesus, in the Jesus model, the church is a movement, not a place, right? In the Jesus model, the church is a movement, not a place. Now, for most of you, when you hear the word church, you think place, right? Some of you think church, you think sacred place, all right? But the reality is, the first time that word came about in the New Testament, we've talked about this before, in Matthew chapter 16, when Jesus was hanging out with his disciples, he said, hey, what do people say about me? And this is when Peter came up with what we as Christians call the good confession, and Peter kind of spurted out for the very first time in this form. He just said, I believe that you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And Jesus kind of got him and said, okay, whoa, what you just said is it. He said, everything that what you just said, upon that statement, that true reality about me, Jesus would say, I'm going to build my church. But he didn't use the word church. That's how it's translated in our Bible. The word he used was ecclesia. And ecclesia was a word that meant a movement or a gathering or a collection of people around a specific purpose. And for him, Jesus said, around this truth, this reality about who I am, that I am the Messiah, that I am the Son of God, around that truth, I'm going to build my movement of people, my ecclesia, and they will be called out. It was a word that ecclesia was used for the military. They were called out to a specific purpose to go to war. And Jesus said, I'm going to call you out. You are my called out, chosen ones, this movement around the specific idea of who I am. Through an unfortunate translation, and we'll get to that in a couple of weeks, we got the German word Kirche instead of the Greek word ecclesia, and it was translated as church. And so we begin to think of church as a place instead of a movement, but that's not the way it was intended to be when Jesus said it. And so in the Jesus model, the church is not a place, it's a movement. And not only is there not a sacred place, in the Jesus model, it goes further than that. In the old model, the sacred place was the temple, and that's where God or the gods would live. In the Jesus model, Jesus says, no, it's not like that. you are the temple. We'll look in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and it would tell us that we are the temple of God, that God actually lives inside us. There are no sacred buildings anymore, because everyone around who is a follower of Jesus is a sacred building, is a sacred place. The sacred places are all of us. In fact, this building is not a sanctuary unless we are here, right? This is not the church unless we're in it. Tomorrow morning, if you were to come by, it would be pretty quiet and pretty dark in here. And it would just be a room and a building, because there are no, in the Jesus model, there are no sacred places, because the church is not a place, it's a movement. The second thing that makes the Jesus model different, totally different, is, yes, we still have a sacred text, right? We're not throwing the Bible out, so don't get panicked about that, all right? We have the sacred text, but the difference is now everyone has access to it. Right? In fact, much of what we call the sacred text, our sacred text, the Bible, the New Testament particularly, which is kind of the model for the New Testament church, for us Christian people and the followers of Jesus, most of what we call our sacred text started out just as letters, right? They were simple letters to the early church, at the early Christians in different locations that the followers of Jesus, the apostles of Jesus, wrote. And so no longer did only the holy men, the sacred men, have access to the words or the sacred text of God. Now, everyone had access to what God wanted and what the way of Jesus was supposed to be like. They simply were letters. The Bible is not a book at all. It's a collection of ancient manuscripts, and many of those ancient manuscripts in the New Testament were simply letters, right? Letters that were written, passed around to people to read. And so we still have a text. But now everyone has access to it, which means that now no one has to take a holy person's word for what God has said, because everyone has access to it. You don't have to take my word for what the Bible says. You can, in fact, read it for yourself and understand it for yourself. That is the great thing, one of the great things about the Jesus movement. So there's no more sacred places. We still have the sacred text, but everybody has access. And third, there's no more sacred, special sacred men, because Jesus is our high priest. There's no more special sacred men or women, because Jesus is now our high priest. The book of Hebrews over and over talks about the fact that Jesus is our high priest. He is our go-between to God. In the old model, you had to have a special person go between. This was the case in all the religions. You go to the temple of Athena, and you wanted to get in good with Athena. You had to talk to the priest in the temple of Athena, and he would be your go-between. You would give him money or other favors, and he would or she would put in a good word for you and would cause things to be good for you. In the Old Testament model, in Judaism, God was said to dwell in the temple. He was said to dwell in the temple because he actually did. His presence was actually in a certain spot of the temple called the Holy of Holies. And only one guy, the high priest, was able to go into the presence of God. And he was only able to go in there one time a year. And they didn't have to tie a rope on him in case he messed up. They could pull him out. Okay, this was serious business. You had to have a go-between between you and God. And the Jesus model says it's not like that anymore. We don't have to have a go-between. We don't have to say our confession to any human person or priest, because Jesus is our high priest. He goes before us. We confess to Jesus, and he takes our requests and our prayers directly to the throne of God. And so we don't have to have special sacred men, because Jesus is the high priest. So Jesus did away with the old way of thinking and this old temple model. He came to do away totally and to bring something totally new. He did away with the old, but he also instituted a new way of thinking about how it is that we relate to God, how it is that people are to relate to God. For example, Jesus gave new meaning to the sacred text. Right? He gave new meaning to the text. He didn't change what was there in the old, what we would call the Old Testament, but he gave new meaning to it. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Jesus said, all that stuff that you as Jews used to believe, it's all good, but let me tell you, it's pointing to me. In fact, one of the very first times when he was just starting his ministry, he went into the synagogue on Saturday with all the Jewish people like he would do, and he asked for the scroll of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, and he read a part that was prophesying about him. And he said to the people, he said, "Today in your hearing, this has been fulfilled." That's pretty bold. He says, everything that you thought you knew and you thought it was it's pointing directly to me. So Jesus kind of gave new meaning to the sacred text. Often he would say, you have heard it said one thing, but I tell you this. And he wasn't contradicting what it said, but he was showing the true meaning. He was showing what it really was intended to mean. And so Jesus gave new meaning to the sacred text. Jesus also instituted a new covenant with God. That is a new agreement with God, how men were to interact with God. But in doing so, he also gave new meaning to the Passover. Now, for us, that doesn't really mean much, right? But to the first century Jew, the Passover was the thing, all right? Now, for us as Christians, the thing, you know, the religious holiday, you know, maybe Christmas or Easter, you know, you can kind of pick, you know, which one you like the best or whatever. But for the Jew, Passover was kind of the combination of Easter, Christmas. It was all rolled into one. This was the thing. This was the holiday, the celebration that they celebrating, commemorating their relationship with God. This was the event. There was a few others, but this was the pinnacle event of what they were, to who they were as God, as God's chosen people, and how they related to God, and everything came around this. And so, when Jesus got them together the last week of his life, and he got them together during the week of the Passover, and was going to celebrate Passover meal with them, this was not unusual for them. They celebrated Passover every year. It was a big thing. And so Jesus got his best buds together, his disciples, and he said, I'm going to celebrate this Passover with you. But then, instead of just doing it the right way, the regular way, Jesus reinvented it. He said, here's this unleavened bread that was a big part of the Passover. And he said, let me tell you what this unleavened bread means. We look at them as little crackers in the plate that we pass by every Sunday. He said, let me tell you what this really means. This really is about me. This is really about the death I'm about to die on the cross. And his disciples are like, this is the Passover, all right? This is big. This is about when we left Egypt. This is what God did for us. Jesus, you're cool and all, but you're messing with tradition here. This is the big one. And Jesus then took the cup of wine, which had tremendous significance in the Passover meal, and he said, let me tell you what this means, what it really means. This has to do with the blood that I'm about to spend on the cross. And they had no idea what he was talking about, but it was like mind-blowing for them. It's like, whoa, this is the big one. You can't change this. And Jesus said, I'm telling you what it was really all about. I'm changing it. I'm telling you this is totally new thing. I'm bringing new meaning to the Passover. Luke chapter 22, verse 20, he said, and this is a verse that we say often during our time of communion because we're remembering exactly what Jesus said to you. We're not remembering the Passover anymore. We're remembering how Jesus reinstituted the Passover. He said, in the same way, after the Passover dinner, he took the cup that was part of that Passover dinner. He said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. This is the beginning of a whole new thing, a whole new agreement between God and people. It's not like it used to be. The Passover, that was great for the time, but let me tell you what it really means. So Jesus instituted a whole new covenant and a new meaning to Passover, which was totally new for those people. Finally, Jesus instituted a new movement-defining ethic. A new movement-defining ethic. We find it in John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35, where he says these words, a new command I give to you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Jesus said, this is totally new. I'm giving you the filter through which to look at every part of your life, through every action, through every activity, through every religious thing, through every non-religious thing, through every part of your life, your family, your work, everything. And it's this. Look at it through the filter of loving one another. He said, this is how people will know that you are my disciples, by this thing. He said, as I have loved you, you should love one another. And that was of tremendous significance to those first century disciples who heard it for the first time, because just before that, the event that occurred just before that, some of you know the story, is when, again, at this Last Supper meal, where Jesus came in and before the meal, he washed the disciples' feet. That was the job that was saved for the lowliest of servants, but nobody had done it because nobody wanted to serve each other. And Jesus, the leader, got in and washed their feet. And then lots of stuff happened. And then he comes back and he says, this is how you will know the world will know you're my disciples. As I have just loved you, as I have just served you, as I have just shown love to you, you love other people. In other words, guys, you have no clue what's about to happen, but this thing is about to blow up. All right, this thing is about to get big. And in a few days, in a few weeks, in a few months, when you're at the top of the organizational chart, right, and you're starting to think you're pretty cool stuff, right, remember, this is the ethic of my kingdom. This is the ethic of my way. As I have loved you, you are to love other people. So Jesus instituted a total new movement-defining ethic. It's like, all that stuff, let's boil it down to this. By this one thing, people will know you're my disciples if you love one another in the way that I have loved you. And the reality is, Jesus came and instituted a totally new thing. When he came, he did away with the temple model, instituted something that was entirely new. And the early church, they got it for a while. They did it pretty good for a while. But then something happened, and other things, this temple model started to creep in. And to find out how that happened and why that's such a bad thing and how we can make sure it doesn't happen to us in our time, you got to come back next week. Would you pray with me? God, thank you so much for loving us enough to send Jesus. God, not just to clear the way to you, but to make a way to you. God, because all the other models, all other religious models, rely on us to do something, to earn our way, to make good. And God, we just can't do that. We couldn't do that. No one has ever been able to do that. And so thank you for sending Jesus, not just to clear a path to you, but to make a path to you. God, help us to get this right. Help us to understand the new thing that Jesus came to implement, this new system of the way that we relate to you and to one another. God, help us to be some of the people that begin to get this right again and to help the world understand what your brand, the brand of Christianity, the brand of the cross, is all about. God, we love you. Help us to have the wisdom to know what to do with what we have heard and what we will hear and the courage to do something about it. In Jesus' name, amen.